You're up to Perek Tetvav, Pasuk Yud Zayin. We were halfway. Yeah, we were halfway through this this speech of Eliphaz. So what's happening in this latter half of the Perek? So he continues on his his theme of you people that terrible things happen to terrible people. And the like. So he says, Acha vashmali vizechaziti va'asa pera. I will tell you, hear me, that which I have seen, I will declare. Now that's already interesting, because what does that word imply? Right, that which I've seen, zechaziti. Right, that which I've seen. You might have thought it's like prophecy, right? So it's possibly prophecy, right? So the Malbim suggests, at least in one of his readings, that it's prophecy. Where others say, no, it's like, the Svarno says it's more like, ra'iti, like what I've seen and I learned and from wise people, right? But that once you start talking visions, it suggests that he's actually claiming prophetic backing for what he knows. The reason that you would go more in the Svarna's direction is the next pasuk, where he says, "Asher chachamim yagidu v'lochikadu me'avodam," that wise men have told me and they haven't denied from their fathers. So, if you actually think it's prophecy, why does he also need Mesorah?
Right.
But if you think it's more like I've seen, I've understood, so you understand, I understand from different sources. The other possibility, the Malbim, who does think it's Nevuah, so how do you deal with this Perek, or this Pasuk, what do you think? Yeah, meaning, if Eliphaz knows what he knows through prophecy, then why is he then invoking wise people? Like, what have you added?
Because the Sarah is even more important.
Sure, you could do that. You could definitely go in that direction if you want. I wasn't going anything that fancy. I think the Malbim has it right, is that if you think it's Nevuah, but remember, he's not just telling Eov, I'm right. He's telling Eov, I'm right, and you should know this. Right, so if he got a prophecy just now, so he might be right, but there's no reason that he should assume that Eov knew what he was saying before. Even on the other hand, he has prophecy, but his prophecy bolsters a widespread tradition amongst wise people. Then he can say, I have a prophecy, and you should know it, because this is, right, my prophecy just put the stamp of approval on what everybody knows anyways. Right, so that, which I think is a very clever way of taking it. Lahem livadam nitna haaretz v'lo var zar betocham. To them alone was the land given, and a stranger did not pass through them. Now, what does this pasuk mean? Who's the them? Right. The problem is there's no direct object. Obvious. So Rashi assumes that the direct object is something that isn't here at all. Which is Bishar Ze Zacha Yehuda Malchut Netzach V'Natlu Shnei Menachala. In this merit, the kings of Judah inherited Gurlo Garshu Menachala Tam Bavanam Me'achar Shehodu V'Lavazar B'Tocham. What he's saying is, Reg Shabbat Moshe Levaracham, that the people of Yehuda, because they admitted their sins, right, this is a rabbinic trope that Yehuda, the part of the reason that Yehuda becomes the nation of kings and why David is such a good king is because they admit their sins. So it's in that merit that they get it. So you too should admit your sins. Right? It's a very hard read. The Rikara goes in the opposite direction, right? Which is because he says that no, it's responding to Eov's critique, which is, doesn't it seem to you that the wicked own the land? Right, kshata roe rishei ador shelahem levadam nitna aretz. Right, meaning he's going to say, it seems like the wicked own the land, ... Shadal rikimchi, say, no, the direct object is what we had in the previous pasuk, which is the ba'alei chokhma. Right, the wise people, that they are the only ones who really succeed, and therefore don't claim that the Rishayim succeed. It's not true. The only people who really succeed are the tzaddikim. Um, Kol Yemei Rasha, and that's his contrast to the next pasuk, which is Kol Yemei Rasha Umitchalel Mispar Shanim Nitzmenu La'aretz. That all the days of the evil one, he has pain, and right, he's oppressed. So again, Rashi L'shitato says that it means the Rasha who doesn't do tshuva will suffer. Right, so Rashi reads this whole thing about tshuva, which is you should do tshuva. If you do tshuva, then even if you sinned, you will succeed, and if you don't, then you will suffer. The Rikara, who said the previous pasuk was already about Rishayim, right? He said the direct object he learns from the following pasuk, which is a very weird read, right? But he reads in advance is that they, you think that they're running the world, the Rishayim, but it's not true because they're going to suffer, right? So you understand how he's reading it, right? That he's reading the direct object is coming from this pasuk read back into the previous pasuk.
What is the second half of the pasuk saying?
That for the number of years that are laid up for the oppressor, right? Something like, right, he will be oppressed for his whole life, right? Meaning, so for the Rikara, this is the direct object of the previous pasuk, that you think they're the Rishayim are doing well. It's not true, right? They're going to suffer, right? Meaning if you see that they're, you know, that they're succeeding, that's a blip. But it's not really what's going on. The Malbim says, yeah, the success that you see is superficial. Right? He has terror in his ears. And even when in a time of prosperity, so the destroyer will come against him. Now this almost definitely is referring now to the Rishayim. Lo yamim shuv mini choshech v'tzafuyu alei chariv. Right? Darkness won't, he'll never believe that darkness will turn away from him. I mean, it's not just that he will suffer, it's that at some point he will despair. Right, which is an added part of suffering, but also obviously very relevant to Eov, that it's that despair that's really driving him. No deid hulalechem ayeh yadaki nachon v'yado yom choshech. He wanders for bread, and he just said, "Where is my bread?" Right, that even basic needs. I mean, he knows the day of darkness is ready at hand, as JPS translates it. Right, meaning he knows that the end is over. Yilatu tzar mitzukat et kufu kamelach atid lakidor. Right, he's overwhelmed by distress and anguish. And this is a very powerful image that they beat him. They prevail against him like a king ready for battle. Right, meaning he's at war with suffering and they're winning. Right, that's the imagery. Right, and the Ibn Ezra adds, yeah, because a king who's about to go to war, like, there's nothing, you know, nothing as scary as that. Kinata el yadov el shaddai yitkabar. And what's the reason? Right, what is his evil? And right now we come back to Eov. His evil isn't just whatever sins he did, is that he stretches his hand out against God, and he's arrogant against God. Right now for the Rashbam, right, this is actually referencing some of those wicked kings, like Sancheirev, right, that they are punished because of their arrogance. Obviously, he's implying that, yeah, right, Yarutze la vitzafar bavi gabe maginav, right, he runs upon him with an upright neck and the thick bosses of his shield. Right, so again, Rashi is, he's, that's how he translates it, but Rashi says that the bosses of a shield is like the shield. What?
I've never heard of that.
Yeah. Right, so he's, you know, these people are running against God. Right, they cover his face with fatness. Right, meaning something, probably something like, right, it's not just arrogance. It's the hedonistic, you know, the extreme hedonism, you know, that leads him, or is there an expression of, or leads to his sin, right? Like you have throughout Dvarim, that when people are rich, so then they go against God. Right, he dwells in desolate cities and houses where no one would live, which were ready to become heaps. Right, and again, the Malbim highlights is the fact that, yeah, this wicked person, as much success as they have, he's eventually going to be terrified. That's what he's saying, right? That it will end badly. Eventually, he will be in despair and fear, and he won't be able to enjoy anything. Lo yashar, velo yakum chelo, velo yatel arts min lam. Right, he won't be rich. He won't have sustenance. Right, he won't be able to produce from the earth. Lo yasur min echoshek yonakto tiabe shal heved yasur baruch piv. Right, he won't be able to leave darkness, or out of the darkness, the flame will dry up his branches. By the breath of his mouth, he shall go away. Right now, what does this mean exactly? Right, Ricard says that yonakto isn't his branches, it's that which gets sustenance from him, meaning his children, right? So his children will die, or he won't get sustenance from his children. The Malbim says, no, it's that this guy's going to be so afraid, basically he's going to, you know, live b'makom or, right? Meaning he's going to, right, he's going to basically, he's not going to live in civilization anymore. He's like running for his life, and he's going to like, you know, be in like a sunny place and wither up and die, right? Like, you know, he's like living out there in the middle of nowhere. Al yemein v'ashav nit'eh, ki shav t'yeh t'murato. Let him not trust in vanity, deceiving himself, for vanity shall be his recompense. That's actually a nice translation. I should have taken the altar one.
Did I get it?
Sure. Right now, again, the Rashbam says that this is going back on Sancheirev, right? It's a particular person that he's asking historically to think about, of how Sancheirev, after being so arrogant against God, he goes back and he's killed in an assassination.
When is he taking this as a
card? What?
If this is referencing Sancheirev.
He's using it as a mashal, right? That it's, right, that just like, you know, this wicked, you know. Yeah. Oh, yeah, this is nice. Yeah, meaning on the, just going back for a minute, right, altar on the fat pasuk, right, he says, the image of a fat warrior may seem incongruous, but excessive fat in Psalms is an image of wicked complacency and self-indulgence, and indulgence. The borderline, moreover, being between fat and robust, is a little vague in the ancient Near East. Below Yomoti Malaydi Chipa Tolo Ra'anana, right? He will wilt, right? Again, this is him as that tree, right? Untimely, he will wilt, and his boughs will not be green. Yachmos Kagefen Bisro, Vyashlech Kazain Itzato, and he'll shake off the unripe grape as the vine, and he'll cast off his flower as the olive. Right, or he'll shed, maybe that's, yeah, Alter says he will shed his unripe fruit like a vine and cast off his bloom like an olive tree. Again, he's, right, he's imagining, like, dying, right, like, you know, ki adat chanef gamud ve'esh achlale, shochad, for the crowd of the tainted is barren, the fire consumes bribery's tent, haro, amal v'yalod aven uvitnam tachin mirma, right, pregnant with wretchedness, giving birth to crime, their belly prepares deceit. Alter is a very good translator. Very poetic. Okay. Now, the big question that we've talked about, you know, over and over here is, how much do they believe this? Right? He comes here super convinced that only bad people suffer. And therefore, and Eov should know that. And therefore be totally convinced that if he's doing, that he's suffering, he must be evil. But how much does he believe this? So here, Red Churchiner cut out a few pieces from Carol Newsom's book. But as I said, you should really read the whole thing. I wish I had a hard copy, but I borrowed his copy when I was in Toronto, which is when I read it. But she writes as follows, right? Yet, if such statements were intended as universal exceptionalist claims, only a deluded fool could believe them. And whatever the friends may be, they are not fools, right? Meaning at some level, you could believe that they said this, but she doesn't think that. And many, right, do they really believe this? Like, do they really believe that nothing bad ever happens to good people and bad people always suffer? I mean, do they really believe that? What is at stake between Job and the friends is making evident the nature of the world, where each attempts to communicate through vivid evocations. This work of disclosure is the work of metaphor, the seeing as that produces redescriptions of reality. Thus, the dialogue between the friends and Job becomes a struggle over metaphors and a conflict over stories. The claim about reality, that, namely that justice exists, however unobvious it may appear to modern readers, was one of the most widespread and fundamental beliefs in the ancient Near East, attested to in many literary forms, though given its most articulate expression in wisdom literature. Restated in conceptual terms, as opposed to metaphor or example, this belief is that good and evil have different relation to reality. The resilient, enduring quality of good derives from its participation in the structures of creation itself, whereas evil, no matter how powerful and vital it appears, is actually fragile and subject to disintegration because it has no root in the order of creation. One cannot convince another of the truth of this perception by means of argument, for the issue is fundamentally one of perception itself. Rather, as Raphael Deimos says, one can only evoke a world, a vivid pattern of a whole. The persuasive power of an iconic narrative does not derive from a simple empiricism. Although it cannot be wholly disconfirmed by experience and remain plausible, the story remains surprisingly resilient in the face of a mixture of conforming and non-conforming experience. Right, so this is, right, if you remember, this was Moshe Lichtenstein's, right, in basically overview of the whole book, is are they putting out philosophical arguments, or is this a religious book, right, about religious experience, right? So Newsom is saying the same thing. She's not saying that, she claims the friends don't actually believe this ad hasof in terms of it's never happened. It's, this is true at some deep level, and this is how you're supposed to experience the world. Right? Rather than, there might be exceptions, but you're not supposed to experience the world as such. And then she gives an example. An example from contemporary American culture may illustrate. Consider popular business literature in which the story is told over and over of the individual who turns a creative idea into a flourishing business. This is the iconic narrative of entrepreneurial capitalism. Everyone knows that the large majority of new businesses fail, yet the story does not lose its power. The story is seen as expressing the nature and essence of an entrepreneurial society with all the static cleared away.
Right.
Right. Meaning we know that entrepreneurs sometimes fail, but we tell the stories of the ones that succeed because we want people to live in a certain way. An anecdote about the success of the wicked cannot explain the reality of this world of values, which is experienced as such every day. Such things may happen, but they are perceived as anomalies. Right. So this is what she claims he's doing. He's not denying that it ever happens. He's saying you're supposed to view wicked suffering as an anomaly and live your life as if suffering corresponds to evil. And therefore, if you're suffering, experience it as if you're evil and do tshuva. Even if it might not be true, right? Which is a very interesting claim, right? Lacking is my word, power. But the story of the wicked overtaken by calamity, like the story of the restoration of a good person, rings true because it is consonant with the foundational values of the society. Now, I think I've mentioned this before, but Rav Moshe Lichtenstein argues elsewhere that this is the difference between Mishlei and Kohelet. Right? That Kohelet says, good things happen to bad people, bad things happen to good people. And Mishlei is overly simplistic. You know, the father tells his son, do good things because good things happen to good people, and don't do wicked things because all wicked people end up dying a terrible death. Right? So according to Chazal, both are written by Shlomo. So right, how do you have them? And he says it's very simple. The simple pshat is that Mishlei, who is the audience in Mishlei over and over? It's a father to son. Right, Bini, listen to me, my child. Especially the first half of the book.
Yeah.
Right? So he says, listen, Mishlei is an intentional oversimplification. It's not that bad things don't happen to good people. It's that when you're educating your children, there's like a deep moral truth to saying, don't be bad because bad things happen. We know there are exceptions, but you want someone to live their life as if doing the good thing is obviously right. Even if we know that sometimes things don't work out. Kohelet is like, you know, the old man bemoaning the fact that things don't always work out. But educationally, there's something important. Experientially, there's something important about that oversimplistic story. So Newsom is arguing that that's what the friends are doing. They're not necessarily saying there are no exceptions. They're saying, as a religious person, that's not how you're supposed to experience the world, right? Similarly, right, like you have David HaMelech says, Lo ra'iti tzaddik ne'ezav. I've never seen a tzaddik who's abandoned. Right? Meaning, do you think he never saw that? So no, right? It's more of a prayer than assertion. Right? Meaning, it's happened. And remember, David HaMelech had known dire circumstances. Poverty, flight, life as a fugitive, right? He did suffer. Right? And yet, he says this. Meaning, right? Despite the fact that he suffered, he can say the words, "V'lo ra'iti tzadik ne'azav," that because at some level, that's a moral truth. You experience your life that way, right? And at some level, that's really what Eliphaz is critiquing him for. It's not, you know, the fact that it's what he's saying is impossible, is that that's not the narrative you're supposed to live your life by. Okay.